you know, with the long, long fingers and contact lenses. And so my eyes were very like bright and angry, and my hands were bloody. And yeah, I made a couple of kids cry, and it felt it felt really good for some reason. I was like, okay, yeah, I'm actually in
character.
That's
so twisted.
Hey, hello. Hello, Austin. How are you doing?
You sounded like you were addressing a crowd, like, hey, and then you, like, turned to me next to you on stage. Hello.
Okay, then let me start again.
No.
Hello, everyone.
Better. Good.
I'm opening my arms to everybody present.
Canvas is like, what on earth is happening?
Yes.
Hi. Our conclusion to Halloween month.
Yes.
Sorry we had to skip a week. Sorry to you, Angela. I appreciate
it's okay.
I mean, we both had stuff to do. And we took some super cool photos.
Oh, yes. Yes. I forgot about it. I was excited to share our experience, and I forgot completely. Thanks for the reminder. But yeah, we already finished our Halloween costumes and did a photo shoot and everything, and we're excited because we're waiting for those photos. We're supposed to have them tonight in hopefully a few hours. So we'll see. I'll be sharing those pictures later this week, hopefully before Halloween. And yeah, I'm very excited. Actually, we could tell them. Yeah, why not? I mean, okay. they're so cool. They deserve to know all the information.
Yeah, I mean, look, Camus is very excited right now. She's like, tell him, whip it out. Well, so as a kid, I was very fixated on Dick Tracy, and there's one adorable photo of me as Dick Tracy as a young kid, and
adorable
a costume
photo of you.
Yeah. And it is my assumption. Don't let her chew on that pillow.
She does it just to get my attention.
Yeah, it works. Evil. Yeah, as a kid, I was very into Dick Tracy, and so after some discussion, we came to the conclusion, let's do it. Let's return to the roots. And I think
after trying to convince you for, I don't know, well, yes, for months, asking you to cosplay with me again. It's so hard, actually, guys. It's so hard to get Austin into this because obviously he's not used to do this kind of thing. Not like this professional photo shoot and all that. So it is a little hard to convince him, but I remember that picture and I offered to make that costume, and so it's like the best option I had to not beg too much.
I really feel like my mom must have made that one when I was a kid, because I can't imagine they had Dick Tracy costumes for young. I mean, maybe they did, but it was not long after the movie came out. But is Canvas like going crazy?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's
okay.
That's
so funny. She's very excited. So anyway, yeah, there's some awesome Breathless Mahoney and Dick Tracy duo shots and some solo shots of each, and they're going to be freaking awesome. Our friend Alf, who is a pretty brilliant photographer.
Shout out to Alive Alf on social media, because he is the photographer who took our Adams Family pictures last year. We loved them so much that we decided to call him again and do this. And yeah, I'm excited to see the results. I know he did a awesome job, and yeah, I'm so excited. I mean, Dick Tracy is, what I liked about that project is that it's so colorful and vibrant and moody and so much contrast and so cool. And I was excited to see what he managed to do inspired by that.
And one of the things that I think is awesome about him is his precision. So when I have taken your photos in the past, my strategy is basically to just point the lens and take 5 billion photos in the hope that, like, this machine gun spray of shots will yield one decent one. So we'll take literally, like, hundreds of photos for a 30-minute photo shoot. And Alf is like this guy. He'll close his eyes and think and picture the shot and picture how he wants to paint the light. And then he looks around. He positions his flash and his other, like, background light and whatever how he wants. And then he takes one photo. He takes a shot. And you look at it, and it's like, even in the camera, before color balance and any other kind of post-processing work that you might want to do, it looks amazing. Just blows me away that time and again, he'll just conjure it in his mind, and then it's like a sniper who takes one bullet as opposed to, like, this, you know, machine gun nest that's just pouring. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really admire that ability.
It's the opposite of me. I prefer to have 100 and pick one that is very good. But he's like, takes the time to take one that is excellent.
But they always are. I mean, his worst ones are still better than most people's best ones.
Yeah, that is what he does. So yeah, totally recommend it. He specializes on cosplay photography, but he does a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah. So yeah, so that's our photo shoot that's coming up. I know that we have people's comments and things that we wanted to read. I remember we were originally talking about the idea that we would have
everything Halloween.
Yeah, we would have an episode about horror literature, and so I just wanted to throw out something I probably would have mentioned. Even though it's like the most cliche, if you're talking about the world of horror, like the like horror literature, you know, Edgar Allan Poe is kind of the godfather. It's like if someone says, name a great horror author, and you say him, it's the equivalent of saying, well, name a painter, and going, well, yeah, Picasso or like Monet, or you go, well, yeah, okay, everybody knows them though. But I gotta say, when I was a kid and I read his short stories and poems, they really made an impact. And like, I remember I had to memorize the Raven in school.
You had to memorize
it? Well, we had to choose a poem to recite for the class. And it had to be more than just some 5-line poem. Like, it had to be a real poem, like a page
but
or several pages long.
But that is a long thing. That is like a 10-minute.
I spent like two weeks learning it.
Wow.
And I remember my parents had their 20th wedding anniversary, and they left town for like a week to go on a little vacation. And my grandparents came and stayed with me. And I remember practicing reading The Raven to my grandparents over and over and over for school. It was one of those where, like, as a kid, I thought it was sort of creepy and cool. And then I got a little older and read it again. And I remember feeling like, this is actually genuinely kind of like beautifully creepy, gothic imagery. And and I bring it up because I love the memory that we share of when we went to Stanley's like kind of public memorial tribute event that they held at the Kodak
that was
Theater
2 years ago.
No, I mean, it was before the pandemic.
They did it.
Yeah, I mean, 2 years ago is still the pandemic. So
yeah, for sure.
Maybe three or four years ago now. But
wow,
it was an event they held that you could just buy tickets for, and they were for charity. Right. And Lawrence Fishburne from The Matrix, Morpheus from The Matrix, came and said, Stanley's favorite poem is The Raven, so I'm going to read The Raven. And he read the entire Raven, which was, and they turned all the lights out other than a tiny little spotlight on him.
Yeah.
In that big theater. Good. And that was so memorable and so affecting. It was such a beautiful way to go, this is for him. We're just going to enjoy this piece of famous literature for the moment. And anyway, I just loved that moment. And even though it's, you know, only kind of peripherally related to Halloween, it's something that always comes to mind in these sorts of.
That's a good memory. I forgot.
Yeah,
so
that was
great.
That was a cool event. There was
so cool that day. That day, who was there again?
A bunch of people. Saw Kevin Smith and Mark Hamill and.
Oh, yeah.
And,
so cool.
Who else? A bunch. I mean, it was like 50 big name people.
Yeah.
And
Luke and Morpheus in the same room.
Yeah, and Kevin Smith.
But
yeah, in any case,
are you doing any Halloween stuff this weekend?
Negative.
Are you just gonna be working? You're going to events, so I
this weekend,
know.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be at the premiere of the Assassin's Creed Symphonic Adventures in Paris. Which is
where is that?
When? This weekend.
Yeah, but which day?
Oh, I don't know. Saturday.
Ah,
Saturday.
Okay. Nice. Congratulations. That sounds exciting.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. I can't wait. And so I'm sure there will be cosplayers and people like that.
Oh, and, yes. Please take pictures and share, please.
I will.
I'm excited to see others.
Yeah, it should be fun. I remember the last time I went to Paris for an Assassin's Creed concert, there was a handful of like Jacob Fry cosplayers that I took some photos with.
Nice.
But this one, I think they're going to make a bigger deal. Yeah, Jesper Kidd and I will both be there, and
nice.
It should be quite fun. And
then what else do you have?
Then I come home. Just takes
what
a little
about,
while to get
what
home.
What about? Do you have like a event, a convention?
No, so I'll have a chance to have dinner with Troy because he's in London for a convention. I'll have dinner
with him.
I think
I got confused. You have another thing with Andrea, and I was confused.
That's a month from now. Yeah.
Oh, okay. We shouldn't be talking a schedule here in front of them.
Yeah, you can get rid of all that.
But,
that Milan Games Week, Troy and Andrea and I will.
Nice.
We'll
actually, that might
together.
Be interesting just in case somebody from, I don't know, close over there.
Any Italian listeners? Yeah,
know,
hey,
maybe.
Sure, why not? I love it. In any case, so, but that was the one thing I remember. And I remember we were going to talk about horror music at one point. And
yeah. I had actually, you know what? I had notes about the last episode. I had, and I don't even remember. Look at what I wrote. Shock 1977. That's a movie.
Huh.
And music is Libra. And this is a link. I don't even remember what the hell. But if I linked it, it's because it was interesting. Here, I'll share it with you.
I don't know this movie.
It's an Italian...
Italian horror film. I see that, yeah.
Yeah.
How did you come across this? Did you like Google scariest movies ever?
I was just exploring, you know, options that I wanted to talk about. And now I have no memory of why I put that there. I remembered I was super creepy or something. And I wanted to bring it up.
It feels kind of like the one I mentioned, the Italian prog rock band Goblin for Suspiria. This feels like a different band doing a similar thing.
Is that the puppet one?
No, that's Magic.
Because I remember something about
that's Goldsmith.
The
ventriloquist, the like split personality ventriloquist guy. I've never heard this score.
I heard and I was like, holy shit, I should put this down. Anyway, that's something.
I like it.
What do you
think? It's just delightfully creepy. It's very much of that era, you know, that same era that gave us the likes of Tubular Bells and the John Carpenter Halloween. You can feel that it's very much part of that same. It's a little earlier than those others, but certainly earlier than Halloween, I think. But not by much. The Halloween, the horror score to be all, to end all horror scores, in my opinion, is John Corleone's for the movie Altered States from 1980, which is a completely orchestral score. But I remember once I bought this book that was like the 100 scores everybody should know or something like that. I can't remember what it was called. It was something like that. Because it was basically a book of two or three, like it was like one page about a score. So you just like, it's like, you know, it's like those encyclopedia type books, you know, like the 100 movies everyone needs to have watched, where page one is this movie, page two is this movie, page three is the movie. Because you just flip through it, you know, almost like a coffee table book. And this was one where I came across, I just read it cover to cover, you know, when I was like in high school. And I came across Altered States, which I had not heard of. I was familiar with John Corleone a little bit as a composer, mostly does classical music, but I knew his name. But I didn't know the score to Altered States. And I remember I read about it in this book, and it said, it made some comment like, never in the history of cinema has more scary music been heard. And I remember going, you know, okay, you know, settle down. And then I went and watched the movie, and it is actually a very creepy movie. And the score was like the most violently terrifying music I had ever heard. It was one of those where I thought, well, actually, you know what? Credit to the author. It is earnestly terrifying music. Like, it is really barbaric and sort of like, it's like satanic ritual music. You know, it just really feels like he found a way to be just genuinely so creepy. And but like, not just, no, it's not, creepy's not the right word, because creepy to me suggests atmospheric and quiet and unnerving. This is like upsetting. It's like violent.
Yeah, I think I'm more into beauty, you know, like scary, pretty,
right?
Type, you know, Candyman. I remember Candyman was very nice piano. That was not easy to forget.
Yeah, no, it's true. I think I'm the same. Horror, shock value horror is less exciting than things that give you an unsettling view of the world. Or like, I remember, this is a strange comparison to make, but I remember the first episode of Star Trek Next Generation that introduces the Borg ends with Picard at 10 forward talking to Guinan, Whoopi Goldberg's character, where she's the only one who had ever heard of the, you know, because her whole species was basically wiped out by the Borg, and she's one of the last survivors, and she's one of the only people in this, you know, in the Federation that even had heard of the Borg. And so when Q makes the Enterprise interact with them and then sends them back to the Alpha Quadrant, the episode ends with her at the bar. Most episodes of Star Trek Next Generation end with like, hey, we did it, off to our next adventure. And there's like an optimism, and there's like a success, a victory, you know, and then it rolls into the Goldsmith bomb, ma, 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 and it's very triumphant. And this episode ends with her saying to Picard, you know, there are threats out. Well, Q's lesson was, there are threats that we're not ready for. The world is dangerous. The galaxy is dangerous. And there are things that, even with all of our technology and our supposed intelligence, are beyond us. And she says, Q put us on a path to interact with the Borg and showed us that we're not ready for them. But what's worse, the Borg now know about us and they will be coming. And then the episode just goes to credits. And it's like, it ends with this incredible, like, unsettled feeling of the world is, it's like floating in a cold, dark lake at night and knowing there are things below the water that can and will try to kill me. And cut to black. Like,
wow.
As a kid, it was so unsettling and disturbing is not the right word, but I just remember being so creeped out by thinking, oh my God, what's going to happen next? I mean, it was, you know, of course, and then the next episode has absolutely nothing to do with the Borg. But they do eventually come back and, you know, become like the main villain for essentially all Star Trek from that point forward. But the idea of being left with an unsettling thought is more interesting as a form of horror. Yeah. Not that Star Trek is horror, but like that's a cousin of that idea. Anywho.
Yeah. I just remembered also sometime last week. I remember I found this guy, Big Missy.
Oh, yeah.
His theme for the Addams Family, like the original, basically. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many decades ago. And I didn't know anything about this guy. Yeah, I didn't know anything. And then I found this, like, the Chicken and the Ghost, I think it was. I can't remember. And I loved it so much. That was super fun. It's a very, like quirky, I don't know, scary. I don't even know how to put that. Like, comedy is scary.
Pretty illustrious career in his time in television, and I remember I have a few albums of his, and I'm blanking now on which scores. It's been so long, but yeah, that was a funny. I saw you show up and say, "I've just discovered Vic Mizzy," and it's like
yeah,
there's a deep
share.
Cut.
I am on your Discord. Yes, I know. I do my homework.
I love it.
The Ghost and Mr. Chicken.
That's right.
Yeah, I just looked it up. But it looks like all those movies and, you know, his material is very, like, comedy. I'm not sure. I didn't explore that much, but I listened to the entire Ghost and Mr. Chicken. I loved the main theme, and then I just let it run. So fun.
The score of his that I have is a movie from 1967 called Don't Make Waves. I remember feeling like
do
it
you
was
have
a very
like a
60s.
Spreadsheet? That's how do you found?
Yep, I did. I just pulled it up to look to double check. Of course,
nice.
Who do you think you're talking to? He lived a long time. He was almost 100 when he died. I didn't remember
wow.
that. Born 1916, died 2009.
Wow.
Incredible. In any case, shall we look at some of our comments since we forgot to before?
Yes, please.
We got too excited.
Let's do this. Mm-hmm. Yep.
On the Twitter, Brushes and Keys, when you said what are some of your favorite horror games, I personally felt very vindicated that a lot of my choices showed up there. System
yes,
Shock
I know.
2, Dead, mm-hmm. Dead Space. There was discussion, is BioShock a horror game? I saw a mention of Little Nightmares. I love that our wonderful friend Ben Shirley didn't respond with a game. He just instead showed a selfie of jogging in the rain saying, I'm jogging in the rain, listening to your episode
films.
On horror films, which was
yes.
lovely.
That is
Alex,
lovely. I know. I love it.
Alex Mukala. Everyone should
Yay.
Go follow him. Lovely guy. He suggested one that I had forgotten about and I never played. And he made me realize I should go play that. I remember hearing about it ages ago, which is a game called Outlast, which is reportedly a creepy as all hell game. But I have not played it. And if you look it up, you'll see, like, oh, yeah, this looks like a game that if you play at night, the lights off and all that, it'll scare the bejesus out of you.
I'm very curious to play, but if I'm with you, if not, not going to even try.
Never.
I love it because his comment at the end is like 10 out of 10 will never play it again. So that alone, not even going to try to install anything if you don't agree.
Jake Paxton 9 has a very savvy comment here. They reaffirmed Dead Space 2. They also say Alien Isolation. Big thumbs up from me there. But they say a comment that's very smart, where they said, in my opinion, I think it's difficult to make a game truly scary if you have a way of defending yourself. Like an action game where you get a bunch of big guns is going to be hard-pressed to be truly scary, which is why Alien Isolation is so genius, because the xenomorphs are always dangerous. And you don't really get like guns in that game. Not like Fireteam, you know. It's not really a shooter. You do get guns, but you can't really kill the xenomorphs, like in the same way that they can't really kill them in Alien.
You can't kill them?
Well, look at Alien. They don't really how does Ripley defeat the xeno? She opens the airlock. Like,
I don't know. I kind of like to kill them all, you know.
That's aliens. That's James Cameron, know. You know. But Alien, the whole idea was you can't fill them with machine gun fire. And so, like, the one thing that you can have that I thought was so genius in Isolation is a flamethrower that because they're afraid of fire. The xenomorphs, they shriek and they move away from fire. So if you blast the flamethrower, first off, you have finite ammo, so you have to be very careful because it knows when you run out. Like, it'll test, it'll try you, it'll attack if you run out of flamethrower ammo. So the thing that's so smart is if it's running after you and you whip out your flamethrower and you shoot it, it'll jump back away, and then it just stays out of range and follows you. So, like, you have to hold it at a distance until you can, like, get in an elevator or something and get away from it. And I thought it was so smart that it won't run and hide and give you a chance to hide. It just stays out of range of the flamethrower. And it's so creepy as a result, because there's really ferocious xenomorph that can kill you that's just like waiting for you to fuck up.
So stressful. Yeah, no, it's great. I can't.
That's this Jake Paxton point that, like, if you had a machine gun where you could just kill the xeno, it would be less scary.
Of course.
Fear, Bell Bottom Zydeco says Fear, absolutely yes. BioShock, Hellblade, they think counts as a horror game. And let's see here. Stubbs the Zombie from Rosendar. I don't know that game, but the GIF is funny. It looks like, what's the Left 4 Dead? Like, it's kind of it's Fortnite. It looks a little silly. Yeah. Little Nightmares, Binding of Isaac it's hard for me to think of any kind of 2D side scroller as horror. But I did mention Carry On, which is a 2D side scroller. So I guess I'm breaking my own rule here. It's not a rule, but it's just, if the goal is to be creepy and scary, side-scrolling doesn't feel like that to me. But Carrion isn't scary. It's like fun to be a monster. But in any case, sidestep from most horror games from our friend Trace, Whispering_hour on Twitter. Night in the Woods, sort of a modern indie classic. And it's a lot of this dark cloud that hovers around that game. Very sadly, the sort of lead creator and developer killed himself. And there's a whole story not worth getting into around that, but it does cast a bit of a cloud over that game. But otherwise, a game that I never finished that game, but it was it was in that era when there was a string of indie hits that kind of defined the modern indie era. Night in the Woods was one. Phil Fish's Fez was one. Andy Schatz's Monaco, which I had the great pleasure of scoring, was another one. Like, there were all these games that kind of, like, Thomas Was Alone of Mike Bithell. All these, like, cool indie games came out that sort of, you know, made average gamers go, oh shit, you know, indie games are actually really cool. Maybe I should pay more attention to those instead of just AAA games.
I didn't know there was like a moment in history of gaming that people decided to pay more attention to indie games.
Absolutely, yeah, because a lot of indie developers became millionaires and it made a million people start trying to make indie games thinking I want to be the next one, which led to the so-called indie apocalypse where like now it's a lot harder to be a super successful solo or small time indie in that way because you know, there's so much more competition like that,
right.
that drove demand because, or like that drove a lot of people into the market on the promise of, oh wow, you mean like a guy like Phil Fish releases a game like Fez and makes millions of dollars, or like mentioning Binding of Isaac, the guys that made that and Super Meat Boy, you know, these games, these indie games came out and just made a fortune, like truly millions of dollars. Like there's a great documentary called Indie Game the Movie that played at Sundance about a few of these developers. And they show how, you know, the guys that made Super Meat Boy were effectively, you know, living out of their parents' basement, and then by the end of it, when the game comes out, they paid off all their parents' loans for them. Like,
oh, wow.
they made so much money that they were able to, you know, like take care of their family. Like, it's like winning the lottery.
That's so cool.
It was definitely a great moment in gaming. The Banner Saga was even able to kind of be part of that.
Nice. And, but not anymore, I guess.
It's not that there aren't
difficult.
There are developers that release games that make millions of dollars still, but they're just there's just percentage wise of developers, there's a lot fewer of them now. This is why there's a great GDC talk by an indie developer named Jason Rohr, whose famous game Passage is quite brilliant. Jason's a really nice guy and a really like deep thinker about games. At least in my experience, I've always found him to be very interesting and thoughtful. And he gave a talk where he did a bit of statistical analysis of the indie space to see if the indie apocalypse is actually a real thing. And he came to the conclusion that this is basically a bunch of bullshit, because what he said was there's always been a relatively consistent number of hits. Like, say it's 20 per year, like 20 games that make millions of dollars and genuinely become like the thing everybody's talking about for a while, like Inscription recently, or like Untitled Goose Game, or whatever indie game kind of pops and makes people go, oh wow, or Valheim when it came out, or you know, or Fall Guys, or, you know, like there's always, you know, a certain amount that seems to be relatively consistent. And just because there's more people making games doesn't mean there are fewer hits. It's the same number of hits. There were just more fewer people making them back in those days, 10 and 11 years ago. And
yeah,
so he said
it's more likely to have success, I guess. Now it's more competition.
Exactly. So his diagnosis, which made perfect sense to me, was it's wrong to say that the market has collapsed for indie games due to oversaturation or something like that. There's the same number of hits there always was. There's just more people making them now.
Mm-hmm.
But the number of hits hasn't gone down. So it's not worth looking at it as like an unviable market. It's just a more competitive one.
Right.
But that all markets kind of have that pattern. If something turns out to be a huge hit and not a lot of people are doing it, then of course other people are going to start showing up left and right to try and see if they can do it too.
Yeah.
Those are some of my highlight tweets. What do you have over on Instagram and elsewhere?
Oh, on Instagram, I actually pull up the last week question about Halloween. We're going to stop talking about video games and we're going to just talk about Halloween. And
go for it.
And I didn't think of anything else, so I'm just like, what do you do on Halloween? And I got a bunch of answers here. There's a lot of people sharing, you know, like most of them are eating candy. And actually, there's a good amount of people very proud of sharing full-size bars of candy. For some reason, I don't know why it is
that. What
do
you mean proud of that?
When the kids come to their place, they
give them away. Like they're very proud of their generosity.
Exactly. Which was very funny because it was not one or two or three. It was
actually
several. They said the same.
So I mean, that's a big deal. When I was a kid, when I was a kid and all the neighborhood kids are trick-or-treating, if there was one house that was giving away like king-size, you know, Butterfinger or something, every kid would tell every other kid and everyone would storm that house. Yeah, absolutely, yes.
That is so funny. I don't know, like I'm happy if whatever amount, you know, the weight is what matters. Like they can give me one or 20, but the weight.
That's so funny.
Yeah, I am not familiar with any of this. I just last year, I think I did it once in my life.
Yeah.
And it was pretty fun. It was just, you know, like an hour and a half going around the neighborhood and, you know, dressed up as half Harley Quinn, you know, like super comfortable. Yeah. I got Canvas to come with me and I loved what they did with the houses. Some of them were very committed, which is
awesome. Yeah, that's the best part.
Yeah
I remember when I moved to I moved to Manhattan when I was 18, and you would see like kids trick-or-treating in the apartment building, you know, like on Friends, like little kids open the door to Monica's apartment. And I remember always thinking, what a sad version of Halloween, like, because I had grown up in this like cliche suburb of Denver where it just felt like, you know, and those kids obviously, like, they would probably look at me and say the same, like, you know, so it's not like there's any objective truth to that.
That's so funny.
But just the idea of like, oh, okay, now we're going to go up to floor 6 or something instead of like walking around to a different block, and everybody's, you know, you're passing all the different costumes and like in the E.T. when they put the sheet over, put the sheet over him, and they pass by a Yoda costume. And John Williams quotes his Yoda theme in the E.T. score.
Of course.
It's a delightful little Easter egg. But I remember as a kid, the only trick-or-treating memory I really have, I have two trick-or-treating memories. I remember going once with my friend.
But you did it more than that.
Yeah, I just don't really, there's just nothing really particularly memorable other than you go around, you get candy, and then you go home with your friends and you hang out and eat candy. Like, you know, but I remember once my friend Andy Berglund, childhood friend since we were like 7 years old. And still, we always wish each other happy birthday because our birthdays are only a couple weeks apart. So I was just texting with him, you know,
not that long ago. Wow, that's so rare.
And yeah, lovely guy. I remember one year he wore like a robe and was going as like what it's like. I'm trying to remember if this was actually the thing or if this was someone's guess, but he was essentially like one of the apostles from the Bible. He was a fairly religious guy, although I'm blanking on what particular flavor of Christianity. He wasn't Catholic, so he was some version
flavor.
Of
wow, okay.
Yeah, you know, some particular Protestant flavor. I just don't remember. Yeah. Nazarene. He's Nazarene. I don't know how I remember that, but he was a Nazarene Christian. But he, I remember he was wearing like a blue robe, and he was talking about like, I'm one of the apostles. And somebody answered the door and asked him his name, and he says, my name is Andrew. And they were like, what a great biblical name. And it led to this whole religious conversation. And I'm like sitting there as like a Ghostbuster or whatever, feeling like, yeah, I'm not really part of this conversation, I guess. That's like one Halloween memory of just random, like 2 8-year-olds talking about the Bible. And the other time, I remember a couple years later, I went to an army surplus store and bought, you know, they would have like, you could buy like hollowed out shit, like deactivated, you know, 50 caliber bullets and stuff that can't fire anymore, but they're real because they're from an army surplus store, and like a grenade that's been hollowed out and emptied of all its gunpowder and stuff. And so I remember I bought like camo fatigues and like a bandolier with all these bullets and grenades on it. And I was like, I'm going to be like Rambo, a commando or whatever, except it all looked incredibly real because it was real. It just wasn't viably shootable. And I remember, you know, I had like a ski mask on and I looked like a freaking Counter-Strike terrorist. And, I remember this, woman opened the door and was like, oh my God, like, because I looked like a, you know, like a little warrior was at her door, except I'm like probably 4 feet tall. And But it's funny because in hindsight, you know, that was like the highlight moment was this like woman going, oh, wow. Like she kind of it's like,
right.
That's the essence of Halloween, right? You're supposed to wear a costume that's supposed to actually shock people. The hilarious thing, the darkly. Yeah. Well, the funny thing is now, like, you'd be like arrested for wear, like
for sure.
That's like a very, very taboo idea for a costume now. And probably rightfully so, to be honest. To be like a little kid running around as like a commando is probably in pretty bad taste.
Yeah.
But it was a slightly more innocent time, I suspect.
Right, for sure. But yeah, I remember I had one of those memories of scaring specifically kids. That time when I made the Lady Deathstrike.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with the long, I bet that was long terrifying fingers. For you. And contact lenses, and so my eyes were very like bright and angry, and my hands were bloody, and yeah, I made a couple of kids cry, and it felt really good for some reason. I was like, okay, yeah, I'm actually in
character.
That's
so twisted. You enjoyed their terror.
It's not twisted. I was proud of my work. It was a good day. It was a good day. And I don't say this with malice. I was actually having fun. And that was the best feedback I could
have. Yeah, no, it showed you were obviously very legit.
Yeah. And yeah, I remember I got, I submitted to as a participant in a contest. And I remember I won something. I don't remember if I won the first place or not. Honestly, I have no memory, but I remember. It was hard for me to hold the certificate because of the big hands. But yeah, that was a good day. It was a good day. But yeah, I think that is the only time that I actually wore something that scares somebody.
Wow.
But yeah, we don't do that.
Not even your scarecrow?
No, that was more like shock because when people were, you know, they asked for a picture and I said, of course, yes. They listen to my voice, like they don't know that I'm a female. And whenever they heard my voice, they were like, holy shit, okay, you're a woman.
Yeah,
I remember.
I mean, that cosplay is absolutely, make sure you put a link to a photo of it in this episode, because honestly, that's one of the most impressive you've ever done. And you've done a lot of really impressive ones, but that one is like, I show that to people all the time whenever the subject comes up, and they're always just blown away.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that was fun times because I remember I was so committed to make it look as close as possible that I grabbed a couple of socks and I put I put them on in a male boxer. I was wearing a male boxer.
For your bulge.
You needed a bulge. Yeah, my crotch. So it is more, you know, can see it is very believable that it's a guy. But yeah, that one was nice. I remember wearing wide contacts and I couldn't see very well the entire day, but it was so worth it. It was fun just to see people's reaction. That's the best part, I think. But yeah, we never had that in Costa Rica. I remember all my childhood, that was like forbidden, you know, that was satanic. yeah, all
there's
that.
There's some people in the U.S. that feel that way.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, we don't do that. We're very, I guess, we don't believe in that stuff and it's just all,
it's also like Halloween as it is done here is a pretty American thing. I mean, like all holidays, there's various origins of it and other cultures that have their kind of variant that is a little bit more specific and not quite as
it was super lame because it's like you don't do Halloween, but you do Christmas. So why do you get to choose? Like, I want to celebrate Halloween. I want to dress up.
I just realized another Halloween-related memory I have. Every year, still to this day, The Simpsons starts a new season with a Halloween special they call the Little Treehouse of Horrors. And the first ever scoring session I ever attended in my life was for one of those episodes.
Really? Which one?
It would have been season like 11, 12, 13, somewhere in that neighborhood. It was around the earliest days of the Harry Potter movies because they were like at Hogwarts in the episode. It was like a Hogwarts themed, Halloween episode. So whatever Halloween horror, whichever one that is, yeah. Like Halloween Horror 15 or something.
I don't think I've ever seen it. Like I don't pass.
I know. 10. Yeah. Yeah, it was. It would have been. This would have been in 2002 or so, and I remember actually, you're right. I think now that you say that, in my memory, I was 16, so that would have been in the year 2000, and my dad and I planned a trip to LA, father son, for a few days to just visit LA because I had said someday I'm going to move there and I want to be a composer, and my dad just goes, you know, it could be fun. What if we visited LA? And very lucky. It's the only time we ever did that. My whole life that he just said, what if we did a trip like this? Only a little father-son thing of that nature that we did. And so I remember this was like the early days of email and stuff. I mean, not technically speaking, but for a kid, yes. Like I only had access recently. I mean, year 2000 is, solidly... Yeah. Solidly like 7 or 8 years into kind of consumer grade internet access. But I remember us getting internet in like 95. So it was still pretty new to my life. And not everybody had email addresses. It was like phones and faxes still as like the main way to reach someone, especially a business. So I remember faxing and emailing the general phone number of the American Federation of Musicians Local 47 office, the musicians union in LA, because I knew from being a nerd that all the recording sessions that happened for Hollywood Productions involved the Musicians Union. So I just cold called them and said, I am a 16-year-old kid. I'm going to be visiting LA with my dad, next week or whatever. And I would love to visit a recording session. And I remember the website had like, here's all the different departments. And I didn't know who to email. So I copy pasted my email to everyone there. And so I then walked in the door and they were like, oh, you're that kid that emailed everyone. And so they took me to meet with this guy named Carmen Fanzoni, and Carmen, his job was to basically periodically visit sessions just to make sure that they are abiding by their agreed upon union rules. So he said, I'm going to be visiting a session today. Would you like to come and go to one? And he showed me the list of sessions that were going on that day. And one of them was at the Warner Brothers scoring stage with Alf Clausen recording the season premiere of The Simpsons. And I was like a diehard fan. And so was my dad. And we were like, we got to go. And so he took us over to Warner Brothers and we got to go on the lot and sit. And we sat in the room with the orchestra, that was like not in the booth. And so sat right behind Alf Clausen and
amazing.
Watch them do Halloween Simpsons. And what's fun is those episodes, because they're special, like they're over the top, they're a little bit more sort of cinematic with like a more traditional score than the Simpsons like sitcom style score. Mm-hmm. The orchestra was bigger than normal. It was like a 50-piece orchestra instead of a 25-piece orchestra. So we got to see like a proper Hollywood scoring. And I remember just being so blown away. And Alf was so generous. He came up and he was like, who are you? And I said, I came with Carmen. I want to be a composer. And remember, he said, oh, well, if you want to take a look at any of the sheet music, go ahead. And he handed me a stack of all the conductor scores. And it was all handwritten. It was really special. It was really I remember thinking, wow, the music. I remember it was very impressive music, too.
I'm impressed. I don't think you told me that story before.
I must have, because we went to one of his last ever sessions. You got to see him in action yourself.
Maybe I'm just losing my memory.
Yeah, well, and I repeat myself, I know. But
well.
In any case, so that was a Halloween. So ironically, I remember the music being very beautiful and very kind of like Celtic. And I haven't watched that episode since it first aired. So I don't even really remember. If I heard it again, I'd go, oh, yeah, I remember that was one of the cues we heard. That was one of I'm sure I would remember if I heard it again. I don't really remember, like, scary Halloween music, but it was definitely for a Treehouse of Horror episode. So in any case.
Awesome.
Any other good comments to share before we close it out?
That's so funny because I just opened the comments and I didn't read any. I just said, hey, well, people seems like they like to share big bars of candy.
Well, let's hear a few before we close it down.
So yeah, these are the comments for the giveaway. I forgot to mention that's all the people that participated on the giveaway. They share with us their Halloween activities, and it was so fun to read. Austin, how about you choose?
These are all classics. Eating pumpkin related things, themed parties like costume parties, classic. Sean Malone says string of movies like Blade, Nightmare Before Christmas, Paranorman, Coraline. Halloween treats, baking is definitely a favorite thing to do. A karate class where my students wear cosplay related to Halloween. It's a tradition in my dojo. That's fun.
Yeah, that's so cool. I thought it was very, very cool.
Buy discount candy. Watch classics like Ghostbusters. These are all very solid. I don't see any where I go, holy shit, never saw that one before. These are like, I like that it's the opposite, really, that it's like people upholding these traditions that, you know,
that is so cool.
Are kind of like eternally
enjoyable. I'm
just starting.
I want to do it all. Actually, you know what? This weekend, I'm going to go to a pumpkin patch for the very first time in my life. And I'm going to pick up one pumpkin and I'm going to carve. And I don't know what I'm going to do, but it should be fun. I don't know. My first time. We'll see. It's going to be the last weekend of Halloween, so I'm a little late. But I'm doing it.
No, that's not true. I mean, that's not like that's used to be how it was. It wasn't like a month long. It was always like you carve your pumpkin and then like, you know, put it out like the day or before Halloween or whatever. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I just blatantly am remembering wrong, or maybe it was different where I grew up. But in my memory, Halloween was a day. It was a fix. It was one event. It wasn't like this themed thing that stretched. Like October wasn't Halloween month. In the same way that people go, it's my birthday month, it's gonna be 94 days of celebrating me. We didn't do that as a kid. It was my birthday is this day,
right? And Christmas decorations started at mid-December and not November or
like
even September.
Traditionally the earliest would be the weekend following Thanksgiving. The people who were really hardcore about Christmas would start putting up their lights, but most people would be mid-December. You said.
Yeah. That is I don't mind. Festivities are always so fun.
Oh yeah, I mean, who am I to criticize people having fun and going over the top with like cool, you know, expressions of creativity and stuff. So it's not like I think it's a problem.
Sure.
It's just I just don't want you to go, "Oh, I'm late because I'm actually doing it on Halloween."
Well, I don't know how to, like, what are you supposed to do with it? Like, isn't it the point of like carving pumpkins that you grab the interior to make pies or something? And then is that the
some
dynamic?
People do that.
I don't know.
When I was a kid, the one or two times that we did it, in my memory, you scoop all that out and you throw it in the trash. It's like, because it's disgusting. It's I never liked pumpkin pie. I've never liked pumpkin spice lattes. It's like one of those flavors that some people really love, and it's always bounced off me. And I'm easy. Very few flavors bounce off me. I like most things, but
interesting.
But pumpkin people, in my memory, you just carved it out, and it was like this disgusting slime. And then
so
you
that's
throw
why
it away.
You never wanted to do it, because I've been wanting to do this before, and you're like, yeah.
I am not like that. I don't reject it. It's just not a thing I remember, because I don't sit there going, that's most of the adults that like it because it's a fond childhood memory. And for me, it's a neutral childhood memory. Like, I remember doing it and it's like, oh, that's cool. Like, my parents did their dutiful suburban duty of like, okay, we're going to carve pumpkins this year. And like, it was like a fun family activity, I guess. But I have a million other things that we did that are way more memorable that just resonated more with me, you know?
Yeah.
I have better memories of throwing a Frisbee with my dad on a random Saturday than carving pumpkins.
The future for us, are you even going to carve one pumpkin in my life?
You're making it sound like I have this weird moral objection to it. I'll carve a pumpkin with you.
I hope so. Like, I'm doing this because Austin is going to be in Paris and being, like, famous and stuff. But, yeah, I'm happy I get to do it. So we'll see. I'm going to post a picture whenever I'm done.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to be brilliant.
But, yeah, let's pick one person from here and give this microphone away once and for all. You know what? We have another microphone. We could do another one of this on Christmas. How about that?
Sure.
We can pick another person. So, okay, the winner of the Halloween microphone is DJ Tony D82. DJ Tony D82. Anthony Dennis. Congratulations!
Hooray! Thanks, of course, again to our friends from Earthworks Audio for providing us this and letting us etch it with our awesome brushes and keys, you know. And by our, it's really your excellent work at all the little like Easter eggs and
excellent
symbols and stuff us to give away. They're
elegant.
Solid mics and very grateful to Signal Boost them and for the generosity of having shared it with us.
Yeah, I'm grateful for everybody who was interested enough to leave a comment and participate in this. It was like, you know, it was actually quite a lot of people. Like, I actually don't know if it was like over 100 people. Among, you know, like Twitter and Instagram and also Facebook. But yeah, I'm so grateful for you guys. Thanks for checking out the podcast and for hanging out with us and for catching up and being present on social media, because, you know, it's nice to hear back from you.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So I don't know if there's something else that we should.
No, I guess just now that Halloween month is over, we will have to find a new theme to fixate on. And but yeah, this was a fun way to cluster a few episodes together. Mentally, it was fun.
Halloween general potpourri.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
A cornucopia of horror and terror.
Excellent.
I love it. All right. Well, thanks again, everyone, and I'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.